and salutations, friends, and welcome back to The Arcade. We are your video game podcast here with you for the week of Thursday, August 6th, since we're recording just a day earlier. Once again, we are The Arcade, your video game podcast, coming to you online on iTunes and on the Garbage Hill Network, your home for great Winnipeg podcasts. I am Mike the Legend, who is glad to be back with you once again for another week of coming to you a day earlier. That's just how the schedules broke down once again. I know I said last week that it'd be back to normal this week, and I apparently have been proven to be a fool.
Yes, and by me, who this week, my name is Dennis, the vacation beard. Because, well, I'm on vacation right now, and, well, might as well, one of the things you do when you're on vacation is you grow a beard.
True.
As was told to us by the classic Kids in the Hall sketch.
Certainly.
I hope my real life sketch doesn't end the same way that Kids in the Hall sketch ends, because, man, but still, classic hilarious sketch.
Are you trying to say that the beard will not take over your life?
That's correct.
And you will become devoted to the beard?
Yes.
A slave to the beard?
A slave to the beard, to the point where it drives me to do something super crazy right at the end of the sketch, or near the end of the sketch, before you see the cycle repeat with someone else.
Yes. Yes. So you don't have that kind of vacation beard going yet?
That's correct.
Good. All right. How long are you on vacation for? Is it enough time to grow a ridiculous vacation beard so you show back up to work and look completely different from when you left?
No. Well, it's a couple weeks.
Oh.
I can grow a beard in a couple weeks. Fine. Challenge accepted.
There we go.
All right.
That's the fighting spirit I was looking for.
So, yes.
I'm thinking you should just roll back into work on your first day at the office after your vacation. Full-on vacation beard, fishing hat, perhaps with a rod and reel as well. And look like you literally just came from the lake or vacation straight to the office. No in between.
No in between.
Still,
not even sleep.
You maximized your amount of vacation doing vacation things. And then just straight back to work.
Well, yes. Probably not going to happen, but good suggestion.
All right, fine. Another good idea shot down by Dennis. It goes on the pile of other ideas that just died on the vine.
Yep. Didn't get to be ripened to make that wine that you were...
The ideal wine.
The ideal wine that you so
that I was looking
wished
for
to drink.
Now I'll just have to drink. Now I'll just have to drink rice wine. It's not the same.
But it'll get you really drunk. Just...
Ooh.
Just a word of warning. Don't drink too much of it. It'll get you.
Good idea. Thanks for that.
You are welcome.
Well, now that we're done suggesting various ways to roll into the office after vacation and whatnot, so we are, as we said off the top, your video game podcast. And it's kind of been a busy week in the world of video games and game-related endeavors. So we have a lot to get to on this week's edition of the program, so we will get right into it with our first of two ludicrous leadoffs.
Yes, the first is really just sort of like something we have to mention anyways, because, I mean, Summer Games Done Quick. It's a thing that happens every year now.
Mm-hmm.
It's pretty awesome to watch if you're into speedruns, to see the best of the best doing it live, as it were.
Certainly, if you're not familiar with the names Summer Games Done Quick, or the idea
SGDQ.
SGDQ. It's a charity. It's a fundraising endeavor put on with various people doing speedruns of many games over the course of a week. This year it took place last week from Monday to Friday, I believe it was, or Monday to Sunday. And we're talking about it now because it's over and the grand total has been announced as to the amount of money raised in their charitable effort. It's kind of like a modern day, I guess, very tech savvy telethon, if you will.
Yeah, it's like very much like, you know, the old, like, kids help phone telethons or whatever, mm-hmm. the children's hospital kind of things you would see on TV. Or like the Jerry Lewis telethons,
yes,
kind of things as well. Maybe not to that quite the same level of excesses, and it's not as condensed into one specific period of time. It does take place over the course of a week, but over the course of the week, they did manage to raise a really decent amount of money.
They certainly did. The total that they've announced so far with them raising, I guess they're still waiting for various other payments to come in, and the final calculation has not been released yet, but the number they've announced so far for their tally is 1,230,852 US.
Yes, so just over $1.2 million.
And there is one organization that is receiving all this money. The funds raised are going to Doctors Without Borders.
Yes, it's a worthy cause.
Very worthy cause, as doctors from around the globe go to various other parts of the world that are in need of medical help when crisis breaks out. So certainly $1.2 million is going to go a long way in helping their efforts to help the sick and needy people of the world that require medical attention.
Yes. So in case you're not familiar with what speedrunning is, it's entirely possible you're not. I mean, it's not for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I don't mind it. Mike the Legend's not a big into it. I mean, if you're going to watch people play video games, this is the type of watching video games I think is probably the most worthy to watch, I think.
Okay.
It's not just some guy. It's not just a generic Let's Play. Not going to knock a whole community of people doing Let's Plays. It's not my thing. I don't really get it. Maybe it's a generational thing. Not sure. I prefer to just play the games. But if I'm going to watch someone play a game, I want to watch someone who's awesome playing the game ludicrously, and doing it really fast.
That's fair.
And that's what speedruns are. I mean, there's normally different categories of speedruns. There's oftentimes an any percent, which is more applicable to games that have, like, you know, a percentage base to it, or like, you know, a number of things that you have to get in the game for it to be considered a complete run. But like the any percent, you don't need to do that. You can just blaze through ignoring a bunch of things. Like, you don't need to get all the energy tanks in a Mega Man game or whatever. Or if you can beat the game somehow without whatever. It's some any percent. It's just beating the game as fast as possible. Whereas there's 100% runs that, you know, you need to run through the whole game as fast as possible, get everything. There are two different categories. I'm going to make the assumption that for most of the Summer Games Done Quick, I didn't really get a chance to watch a lot of them this year, but most of them, they probably did an 80% run of all the games. But there was one thing I thought was a little strange about how they ended up doing it this year, which I thought was a little, just kind of weird, and almost like they need to talk to their event planner to ask, or like the producer, just to say, what are you doing? Because normally, like, for any big event like this, you know, you want to, like, save the big hype event for the end, right?
Certainly, the big exciting conclusion, the grand finale, if you will.
And to me, that very well could have been the four-person Super Metroid run, or it's just a race of four awesome Super Metroid speedrunners racing to finish the game first. And that happened. I want to say that that was like the second last thing that happened. I'd have to double check, but it was like the second last thing that happened. What do they do for the last thing? Someone speedrunning Chrono Trigger for 5 hours. I mean, that's cool, but that doesn't seem like the order is right, right?
Was it just one person?
I think it was just one person. It wasn't like four racing people. It was just one person doing Chrono Trigger.
Well, also, it's kind of hard to do an exciting race or multi-person race speed run of Chrono Trigger.
Yeah, or like of any Japanese role-playing game, JRPG, in my opinion. I don't know.
They don't seem like they would easily lend themselves to, you know, an exciting multi-person speed run, because there is a decided pace in the game that you are kind of forced to take.
Yeah. And I mean, like, at that point, it's sort of just like seeing, you know, who can, like, scroll past the text faster, I guess, or, like, who can just run to the next enemy and go through the battle at the pace it's supposed to go through faster or whatever, but...
Or run away from battles fast enough.
Yeah, I guess so. So that just... Plus, it's a five-hour run of a game, whereas, like, Super Metroid can be done in, like, less than an hour. And when it's four people just racing, I feel like that would have been more exciting, just to like have the crowd going wild at the very end. Like,
certainly there's much more of a competitive element to it, which there isn't really with, say, only one person attempting Chrono Trigger. I mean, Chrono Trigger, good game in its own right, but it doesn't lend itself easily to a multiplayer affair.
Yeah. I don't know, just a thought. Either way, super impressive that they raised $1.2 million.
It definitely, and for that reason, the amount that they've raised thus far, the final tally will fluctuate, hopefully only go up in the next couple days before they release the final amount that they've raised, is simply the amount that they raised is what attracted us to the story and caused us to slot it in as a ludicrous leadoff, because $1.2 million in the span of a week...
No, that's really impressive.
Pretty damn good.
No matter how you slice it.
Certainly. So the gaming community definitely came out in great support of this affair, and I can only imagine what they're planning for next year to try and top this year's event. So good on everyone over at Summer Games Done Quick.
Indeed. But so good for them.
Certainly.
So to awkwardly transition into our next ludicrous leadoff, there's no real elegant way of doing this.
Certainly
I
not.
Don't think it's just sort of like a hard transition, so we'll just go ahead and do it. And even still, I'm finding it's hard to do.
I think I might just be able to pick it up from here. There's no easy transition. I mean, we can talk about going from the yin and yang of video gaming, the good positive news of Summer Games Done Quick with the amount that they raised, but then there can also just be other aspects to video game business that is very bad and just negative that can counterbalance the good we see there. And you can argue that negative news kind of came this week in the form of Bungie, who are apparently assholes.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
Because the news coming out this week from Bungie and the development team behind Destiny is that they are removing Peter Dinklage and his narration and his voiceover work from Destiny completely, entirely, 100% being scrubbed and erased from the game.
Yes, replacing him with Nolan North, you know, legendary video game actor, most recently notable, known as Nathan Drake in, you know, the Uncharted games.
Mm-hmm.
He's no stranger to doing narration.
Certainly not.
But I guess this was all sort of, it was brought up because there's an expansion for Destiny coming out, where I guess, you know, it's going to be centered more around your AI companion, and your AI companion will have a lot more to say. So I guess rather than bring Peter Dinklage in, they just thought, oh, let's just get Nolan North in. Maybe he was cheaper, whatever. The point is that they decided that they just liked how he sounded a lot more, so they got him to just re-record everything that Peter Dinklage had originally done, and presumably they're going to release a patch or something that will change the voice of your AI companion entirely.
Mm-hmm. And just get rid of Peter Dinklage's voice clips and replace it with Nolan North doing the same parts, the same script, just his voice.
Yeah, doing his take on it, because apparently he didn't actually hear Peter Dinklage's interpretation or anything. They just kind of didn't want him to hear it. They wanted his version of it. They didn't want any preconceived notions. Fair enough. But the reasoning behind it that really bothers me. The reasoning was that they were saying, well, you know, the gaming community didn't really like Peter Dinklage's performance. They said it sounded uninspired. They said it sounded kind of drab, just dull. Fair enough, I guess, but having said that, they didn't have a problem with it before they released the game. Right?
That's true.
Like, they actually put it into the game as it was. Like, no one raised a concern before they released it.
And in theory, if it was an issue, that would have been brought up, because the voice parts would have been recorded well in advance of the release of the game.
Yeah, not just before.
Certainly not. It would not be a last minute addition to the game to have someone come up and say, you know what, this game really needs Peter Dinklage. We can sell it on the basis of having a notable actor lend their voice to the game. That's really going to put sales over the top. That is not what happens.
No.
The audio parts were recorded far in advance. It would have been known, and the producers and the creative team would have been listening back to the parts that were recorded either as they're being recorded right there in the production booth, or later on at the end of the day.
Yeah, or like whenever. Like maybe someone at some point would have, if it really was like not a very good job, someone at some point would have maybe raised a concern and said, you know, I don't think Peter was right for this role. Because you can't really say he's not a good actor.
Certainly not.
He's a great actor. You mean he's he's like one of like the top actors out there right now. I mean, thanks to Game of Thrones and like,
we'll just ignore Pixels.
Yeah, let's ignore Pixels. But I mean, like, I like Peter Dinklage. I think he's a great actor.
I think everyone does. You're hard pressed to find someone who would say a bad word about Peter Dinklage and his ability and his talent.
Yeah, but I mean, I guess fans didn't like how unenthused he sounded as this AI, and that's fair enough. That's a, that's like a review thing, but it really seems like they're throwing him under the bus by doing this, doesn't it?
And in theory, Peter Dinklage was brought in because they wanted a specific sound.
Because they wanted Peter Dinklage.
They wanted Peter Dinklage and thought Peter Dinklage could deliver what they wanted.
Like, he's got a pretty distinctive voice, I think.
I'd say he does. And they just wanted his voice because it fit in with the style and the overall aesthetics and presentation of the game.
Yeah.
So maybe it's not Peter Dinklage who was wrong, and did poorly with his narration, his voice work. Perhaps it was maybe the direction he was given.
Maybe. I mean, that sort of is why you have producers and stuff normally. It's not like they just said, hit record and go, hey Peter, just record the lines at your own leisure. I'm gonna go out and get a smoke.
No.
It's not like that happened like that.
I would find it highly unlikely that he even just recorded them at home on his laptop and just phoned it in, put in a Dropbox for the guys.
Yeah, probably not.
No, he would have had to go to a professional recording studio, and in theory, Bungie had a member of the creative team there, listening in.
Like, maybe the person who was maybe the producer going, hey, that's good. Hey, let's do that take again. Mm-hmm. Hey, can you do it a little bit more like this?
Okay, put more emphasis on this part of the word. Can you do that? Okay, let's try it again.
Yeah, like, you know, like a director would, like for a movie director, just a thought. I mean, presumably there was someone there. Shouldn't they be throwing him under the bus? It's like, hey, this guy who recorded Peter Dinklage and totally wasted this, you know, opportunity we had with this great talent. Well, he didn't do such a good job, and well, we can't afford Peter Dinklage again. So instead, let's just get, Nolan North.
Because everyone likes Nolan North.
Yeah, sure. Like, that's what that seems like to me. So but no, instead of saying that, we're just gonna say that no, we didn't really like Peter Dinklage. We just preferred Nolan North. So we're just gonna strip away this version. We're gonna strip away this person's involvement in the game that's already out in the public. Like, that's the part that bothers me. It's almost like this thing was released already. People have experienced it in a certain way, and now they're just gonna release a patch and just, you know, roll that part back and just go, nah, maybe you never saw that. Forget all about Peter Dinklage. No, there was never Peter Dinklage. It was always Nolan North.
What if people, the general public, the players, do not like the Nolan North voiceover work to replace the Peter Dinklage parts? Then, Bungie?
They certainly burned a bridge. I would think they burned a bridge with Peter Dinklage, personally, by going, no, we didn't like his performance after all, so we're just totally replacing it. Let's get someone else then. We're running out of voice money. I don't know what we do.
In theory, they would have spent it all already, because to A, get Peter Dinklage on board, he's not coming, you know, cheaply. He's not being paid just in ham sandwiches.
No.
And also to all the time to produce it, to pay for studio time, recording time, engineering time, creative time to bring it into the game and everything else, all the production work for his parts, that's not going to come cheaply either. So no. There's now all of Peter Dinklage's parts, as much as we might think of them as just audio files, there's cost to them.
Oh yeah, of course.
And those costs are now just literally flushed down the toilet.
Yep.
By Bungie.
I mean, it happens sometimes, but I mean,
yeah,
certainly. But it's super weird that it's just, this is already out in the open. Like, this would be like a director releasing a movie going, I didn't like his performance in this movie. Let's just digitally replace this person with another person. That's what it would be like.
That is true.
Right? Or like an animated movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I didn't like how this person performed these lines. Let's just re-record it and then re-release it again, going, oh, cut two. like, people would be like, what are you doing? Like, that's really weird.
That would be almost unprecedented, I'd think.
Yeah, but that's what this is essentially, and that's why this is bothers me so much. It's so weird.
I can't think of another instance where something like this has happened, where just someone has been removed from a game entirely, purely on the basis of not liking the end result. A year after the game, almost a year after the game was first released.
Yeah. That's like, very strange.
Like, you can change voice actors along the way in development, and maybe you're just not liking what you're getting, or just want to take the character in a different direction and need a different voice actor accordingly.
Yeah, but I mean, like, I guess this one's also sort of tricky, because it's an expansion to a game.
But it's the expansion is bringing Nolan North for the new part, but it's also got the patch that replaces all the old parts of Peter Dinklage.
I understand that, but I mean, I guess it is strange that it's not a whole new game. Like,
yeah,
where, like, it's an expansion, and I guess because, you know, Peter Dinklage is a big name actor, and you still have the character he played in this expansion, what do you do? Like, I don't know, like, it would have been better for them just to say, like, for continuity's sake, we just got Nolan North to re-record it, because it would have just been weird and jarring, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that I could buy. But just to say, fans reacted and were just being weird and reactionary about it and throwing Peter Dinklage under the bus, that's the part that really bothers me.
In the announcement heralding Nolan North's involvement with Destiny, Bungie creative director Luke Smith said, quote, "We wanted Nolan North's version of The Ghost to wake you up at the start of the journey at level 1 and follow you all the way to level 40, end quote. So, right there, acknowledging that Nolan North, his version of the character, has more energy to it than Peter Dinklage did. Okay. Nolan North, in the article, in the press release, is quoted as saying, quote, "They really wanted me to put my stamp on it. They let me bring what I wanted to the role. You have to give it your own spin. For that reason, I specifically said I didn't want to hear anything that someone else had done so that I didn't have some preconceived notion of what it has to be. Instead, I just gave it my stamp and let them direct me accordingly," end quote. And in theory, they gave direction to Peter Dinklage. And yeah. The end result is a product of their direction. Would it not be?
Yeah, you'd think.
So that line from Luke Smith is, my takeaway is there's some dickishness in there. That is, I mean, you're saying Nolan North has a lot more energy, and I'm not doubting that, but Peter Dinklage gave you what you were looking for. Otherwise, why was that the end result that you just accepted? If it was not what you were ultimately looking for.
And plus, he's an actor. I mean, I'm sure he's used to directors giving him direction.
Certainly.
Like it would be weird for him not to, unless he really was a diva and they're just really trying to play it safe here. But somehow I don't see that being the case. I mean, maybe I'm crazy.
Well, as an actor, I believe he's also had other roles for animated features, animated TV shows that just are pure voice work.
Yeah.
He's not a complete novice to it.
No.
Also, he's a professional in the entertainment industry. He's been around. He knows how to conduct himself.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't like something he did, but you're still paying him to do it, I'm sure you can go, "Hey, Peter, can you just..." It's like, that sounded a little flat. Can you be a little bit more dynamic about it?
Mm-hmm.
Like, if that's what you actually wanted? Like, I don't know. Like, having said that, though, I mean, maybe they thought that they wanted one thing, then when they got Nolan North in to do this expansion-only version, which would have been kind of weird anyways in breaking of continuity, maybe they heard something in his voice and went, "Wait, that's what we should have had all along." And they just didn't know. Maybe they genuinely didn't know. I don't know. I mean, I'm just trying to play devil's advocate here as much as possible.
I understand.
This is so crazy. I mean...
Does this set a precedent, too, for other companies to just go and retroactively remove elements from a game that people don't like? Just to give in to fan outcry over something?
I don't know. Happened with Mass Effect.
Yeah, that is true. But I'm thinking in terms of people's roles and actors' involvement with the game. Are other companies going to take a cue from this and say, you know what? Maybe let's go back. Some of these lines in Grand Theft Auto V, you know what? I think we can do better. I don't know.
I don't know either.
But it is... It is all kinds of weird, and I hope it does not become just a regular thing. That's just No, that seems very wrong to me. Wrong and just rude. Very rude. There's no manners anymore.
No. Throwing Mr. Dinklage under the bus like that, as if it's his fault that the direction was bad. I don't know. Just
maybe it was the script. Maybe the script did not allow for much energy. Who knows? Either way, look at yourself, Bungie.
Yeah, well.
Well, they did. Actually, I guess they looked at themselves in the mirror and saw Nolan North staring back at them. They're staring back at them. So they thought, let's go with that.
Yeah.
He's a fine-looking fellow. Right this way, Mr. North.
Yes. Oh, Mr. North. Leave this Peter Dinklage guy in the dust. It's like, you realize Peter Dinklage is like a movie star?
He's respected.
He's like a huge name. You know, he's on like one of the top-rated TV shows right now. Just a thought.
He's been nominated for Emmys. Just putting it out there.
Yeah.
Thus concludes the ludicrous leadoffs for this week, and we will move on into the real news of the week. And in Cologne, Germany, taking place this week has been the Gamescom conference, the European equivalent of the E3 conference in Los Angeles, held every June. This one in Cologne, Germany, held in August. And Microsoft was, at the time of this recording here on late Wednesday night, late Wednesday, August 5th, Microsoft has really been the one to make a lot of headlines over in Cologne, Germany at the Gamescom conference. They showed off trailers and demos for a couple of their first party exclusive titles, things like Crackdown, which is now known as Crackdown 3, Quantum Break, which we'll talk about in a minute, just to name a few, but some other, we can't really reasonably talk about the trailers or the gameplay demos because, well, we weren't there to play the games.
Nope.
We're not there to watch the trailers, and ultimately, there's something just kind of unfulfilling about hearing two people talk about something that really you just need to see.
Yeah, exactly.
So instead we'll talk about some of the other big news headlines to come out of the Microsoft conference, their presentation, if you will, that they did in at the Gamescom this week. And one of the big news items is giving a bit more information about the big news item from Microsoft at E3 this year, talking about backwards compatibility.
Yes, we talked about this at the time as being similar to how the Xbox 360 was going to be handling backwards compatibility through a series of patches. Like the Xbox 360 handled backwards compatibility of Xbox original games with patches where, you know, it just filled in the gaps, doing whatever it needs to do using programming to bridge the gap between old and new.
Certainly.
Whereas this one is really going to be more like you download the whole game and it just kind of, you know, you use your disk as the security key, really.
Yes.
As to whether you're allowed to play the game or not. That's how this one seems to work, and that's what we knew then, but we do know a little bit more now.
We do know a bit more,
Not in terms of the technical know-how or anything. No. I feel like that was pretty well laid out.
It was, but now we know when we'll actually have access to this feature on the Xbox One. Mikey Barra was on stage in Germany to talk about it, and he announced that the feature of backwards compatibility is coming to the Xbox One and owners of the Xbox One in November. So we now have it pegged down to a month. Earlier, they had just kind of said it would be by the end of the year. I guess the engineers were having the whip cracked on them, so that's been advanced by a month now. So it's sometime in November when the backwards compatibility will come down. They said that there's going to be more than 100 games available at launch with, quote, hundreds more coming later. And actually for this, IGN actually has been compiling a list as the days and weeks go on of the announced games that will be supported through backwards compatibility. And for the most part, it's the obvious Microsoft first party exclusive titles, but there are some other ones from other companies that will be able to work with the backwards compatibility, things like Call of Duty, obviously Fallout, some of the Splinter Cell games, BioShock and BioShock Infinite, I believe, and BioShock 2. So that is all good news, and hopefully more and more will be announced, as Microsoft has said that they're working with multiple third-party companies and studios to, I guess, get the rights, get the permissions to allow the backwards compatibility of their 360 games onto the Xbox One. The company, Microsoft, also said that all future Xbox 360 games with gold titles will be backwards compatible on the Xbox One. And they also said that the Windows 10 integration into Xbox One will debut in November as well. So that is something to look forward to. But another interesting thing to look forward to that we learned about this week in Germany from Microsoft is the fact that the Xbox One is getting full TV DVR functionality in 2016.
Yes, I remember hearing this rumored sort of back a few months ago. It was just rumored, though. I want to say it might have even been before the great schism that sort of happened in Microsoft there when things sort of went crazy and, you know, the brass changed around at Microsoft. But yeah, it seems like it's going to be a real thing, which does seem sort of odd to me, and it flies sort of in the face of getting back to the games rather than like trying to be the all-encompassing media box that does everything in your living room that Microsoft was trying to do before mm-hmm. the brass changed, and then the brass changed, they're saying, nope, back to video games. But this sort of flies in the face of that. But maybe there was just enough of it already in place before that they figured out, might as well just bring it to the finish line. And I guess that's probably what the case is. But in 2016, we will see when the TV DVR functionality for Xbox One does indeed go live.
Indeed. No time frame of 2016, early, mid, summer, late 2016, none of that's specified, just sometime between January 1st and December 31st. So they could sneak it in December 31st at 11:58 and still say, hey, we're right. But yes. I highly doubt that.
It sounds like it was kind of interesting. It's going to be subscription-free. It works with Windows 10, where it allows you to watch your recordings on a PC or any other connected device. For those of you who still use a DVR to record TV shows off of TV, I guess.
Which is increasingly seeming like an antiquated way of going about things.
It's almost like a VCR at this point.
With streaming services and the proliferation of...
like video on demand.
And set-top boxes
and to just stream people things through. Acquiring things through whatever means on the internet.
Which we will not specify.
Yes, we won't specify because we don't want to actually condone anything like that.
But you can probably guess.
Yes, you can guess. It's very easy to guess.
Those ways.
But yes.
Now, Mikey Barra was on stage also talking about this functionality as well with the TV DVR, and he stressed that it will not negatively impact the technical performance of the Xbox One itself, and he said that the DVR functionality will also work with the Smart Glass app, or the Xbox app on the Smart Glass, to allow users to schedule DVR recordings on the go on their whatever device, their second screen thing that has Smart Glass and the Xbox app. So, okay, good, that's neat. Currently, the Xbox One is able to play live TV, or you can watch live TV through the Xbox One, rather.
Yeah.
So this seems like the next logical step.
Yeah, I guess so.
But the problem is that's going to fill up your hard drive a hell of a lot faster.
Indeed.
Because TV recordings, especially if you have multiple people all under one roof that want to watch multiple shows at multiple times and yada yada, you got to record this for the kids, this one for the wife, this for the husband, this for your grandpa, this for the dog, whatever else. Everyone wants their own thing recorded. It can fill up easily.
Yes. Thankfully, Microsoft, it's kind of surprising this hasn't happened before, but they've teamed up with Seagate, who is a prominent hard drive company.
They are.
A manufacturer of hard drives, that is to say. They're not just a company that has a hard drive, because that would be most companies. Just putting that out there.
Hey, you guys got a hard drive. Good job.
You're a hard drive company. Alternatively, they're not just a company that drives a hard drive or has a hard drive for business or whatever, because also most companies, if you want to stay afloat, you have to have a hard drive. But yes, Seagate is a company that manufactures hard drives, FYI, and Microsoft has partnered with them to really put forward a new 2 terabyte external hard drive, which is made for Xbox One and Xbox 360.
Indeed, the USB 3.0 hard drive, which sadly the 3.0 functionality and speeds will not be fully realized on the Xbox 360. That's more an Xbox One kind of thing.
Yes, because 3.0 is a new specification that only came out the last couple of years, and the Xbox 360 is a little bit older than a couple of years.
It is 10 years old this fall.
Yes.
It is getting up there in years, but it's gonna run you $110. It will launch later this year, though again, specific date, specific time, not announced yet. That seems to be the recurring theme we see in these announcements, but it's going to match the traditional Xbox color schemes of green and black. I believe this one is green on the sides and then black around the perimeter of it.
Okay.
It looks like a pocket-sized hard drive.
Yeah.
Again, with connections through the USB 3.0 framework, and does not require an external power source, so that's a good thing. People wanting to acquire it will be able to buy it at GameStop, along with Amazon and other major retailers. So this will give you some extra storage if your Xbox One, say, only has the original 500 gig hard drive. This is going to give you a lot more than that, or even just if you get one of the, you know, newer 1 terabyte sized hard drives and give yourself 3 terabytes of hard drive space on your Xbox One, you're living. That is, that's a lot of games you can put on there.
Yes, though not as many as you might think. I mean, games are starting to get pretty huge these days.
That's true too.
I mean, like, an average game is what, 35 to 50 gigs?
That's true too, yeah.
So I mean, like, really, if you're thinking about all your games being on the top end of the spectrum there for the Xbox One anyways, at 50 gigs each, really, that's like 20 gigs per terabyte. So, I mean, that's nothing to sneeze at, of course, but spread across three terabytes, that's really only like 60 games.
True too. That's a good point. Plus, once you start adding into that equation,
like save files,
save
DVR.
Files, DVR shows you downloaded through the Xbox Marketplace, movies you're downloading, or even whatever renting. That's going to take up quite a bit of space as well. But what if you're downloading games and TV shows that are connected somehow? Which transitions us nicely into talking about Quantum Break.
Yes, which is kind of a hard thing to explain because I don't think I fully wrap my head around it. Even though I guess I do. They say it's going to be, it's a different type of experience.
That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, it's a game that is tied in with a TV show, but it's also a TV show that's tied in with the game. One seems like it isn't supposed to exist without the other, but both can exist without the other.
It is a multiple medium entity.
Yeah. I mean, I watched the trailer or teaser video for what it was, you know, showing off with a couple of the actors in it, and it was, seems like it could be interesting. It's a game / TV series that both are influenced by each other, quote unquote, which kind of bothers me when they say that because really they're two scripted stories that are going to take place the way that they're supposed to take place regardless, but that's all aside.
Yes, we first learned of Quantum Break back in 2014 at when Microsoft showed revealed it at their E3 presentation back then, but it went unmentioned at E3 2015. I guess they were saving it for Gamescom and Quantum Break being worked on by Remedy, the studio that gave us Max Payne and Alan Wake, excuse me. It's exclusive to the Xbox One and it's going to be coming out on April 5th, 2016. We finally have a release date for it. Apparently Microsoft had originally slated it to come out this fall, but there was a number of high profile games between Forza and Halo 5 coming out that they thought, you know, it's going to get squashed. It's going to get lost in all the excitement between those titles. Let's push it back. Let's delay it and give it its own time when it can breathe and not be trampled on by these other, I guess, larger properties with bigger install bases and fan bases.
Yeah. So basically the way it shakes down is I think the TV show and the game are both going to have the same storyline that plays out, but the game is about the heroes in the story and the TV show is about the villains. So you play one to get one side of the story, you play the other, or you watch the other to get the other side of the story, and then you will get the full story between the two of them. Hooray!
Woo! Okay, good. We don't know quite what this story is about.
We don't know anything about this.
No, we know it's going to star Sean Ashmore, a Canadian actor who we probably best know as being Iceman in the X-Men movies.
Yes.
So that's a good thing.
Yeah, that's a good thing.
It also stars a man whose name I'm completely forgetting, but he was on Fringe because I recognized him from being on Fringe. And a couple of other things that I can't remember him from, but Fringe. He was on Fringe, most yes. definitely on Fringe.
I think I know the guy you're talking about.
Certainly.
And whose name is also entirely escaping me.
This Quantum Break TV show side is being developed, still being developed, despite the fact that the Xbox Entertainment Studios that it was being developed under is no more.
Yeah, so that's two things now that sort of are interesting and sort of fly in the face of, like, the new brass, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, the new brass was saying, no, we want to be just about games, but we're still going to have this weird TV show connected to this game, and we're still going to do a DVR thing on the Xbox. I don't know.
It's almost as if these were projects that were far enough along that they just had to be seen to completion.
Yeah, yeah, probably. I mean, they spent the money. They don't want to waste the money. Money.
That's true.
Probably.
Money. You know, this is a nice idea to have Quantum Break, the experience spread across two different platforms, both the game and the TV show. But I think as we were talking before we started recording here, it almost would be a better or more unique idea to almost make it to where the TV show component would be, you know, what you see and what you experience with the TV show side is dependent on, say, things in your save file of the game and where you've progressed so far into the game.
Yeah. Though a branching story like that would be way crazier to put together.
It would be.
And I can only imagine what, like, the technology that would have to go into something like that. I mean, it would be really cool, but I would also imagine that, like, every scene would have to have, like, 10 variations or 20 variations or mm-hmm. something, and then you just kind of, like, build up, like, each scene would also have to, like, have different branching scenes off of it depending on, like, actions you've taken and whatnot, almost like a weird, like, you know, theoretical physics, like, model of, like, the infinite universes, you know, like, every action spawns an infinite universe off of it, whatever. I'm not going to get into stuff like that because that's not the type of podcast we're running here, but, you know, it would be really cool if they went to that degree where you have a save file, you download this package, like, this is the episode one package, quote unquote. You have to have played up to this point in the game to watch this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay, I'm going to watch the episode now. Oh, that's what happens. Then, you know, your friend over plays the game and does something different, and he downloads a package, and he sees something completely different. That would be really cool.
Or alternatively, some kind of choose-your-own-adventure type television show. It's
really, like, what I'm trying to say is it would be a really complicated version of choose-your-own-adventure.
You know, those terrible books you used to read back in school,
yes.
in elementary school.
The ones that you would always, like, you know, have, like, you know, all of your fingers in the book marking different pages just to, like, you know, make sure to go back just in case. Like, oh, no, I don't like how that one went. I'm just go back here and then go here. I'm going to go page 15 instead. Oh, I die there. I'm going to go back. I'm going to go page 5. Yeah, okay. I always liked those books. That was an interesting idea. I mean, kind of terrible, but still fun.
And now we just need that in TV form.
Yes, we have the technology, but do we have the budget or time?
Ooh, maybe not this generation, maybe next generation, but before we ever get to that, we're still stuck with the current generation. And if you do not have an Xbox One of the current generation,
then you'll never get to play this game.
This game being Halo 5 Guardians.
Yes.
Which I said earlier as being one of the reasons that Quantum Break was pushed until 2016 for a release date. Halo 5 coming out this fall, as all Halo games are inclined to do.
Which is probably a good call that they're doing that, because Halo will be an all-encompassing thing when it comes out, as it usually is.
Certainly. The game itself launching on October 27th, but as of October 20th, you'll be able to acquire the console bundle with Halo 5 Guardians, including a 1 terabyte model of Xbox One system. So you'll get the game and the console, and it's a nifty-looking Xbox One design. It's silver and blue. The controller is themed appropriately to tie in with the aesthetic of Halo 5 Guardians. You're also going to get a digital copy of Halo 5. They can't include a physical one before it's actually released physically because, well, that would just bugger things up. So instead, yes, it's a digital copy.
And you can preload it right away on the 28th, but you have to wait till the 27th for it to unlock.
So, okay, you'll still be waiting that full week, but at least you don't have to download it. But you'll just know it's on your hard drive, and that will torment you.
Yes.
It's so much closer.
Yes.
It's still so far away.
Yes.
The bundle also comes with the Warzone REQ bundle, which features 14 requisition packs, other digital items, including in-game armor, multiplayer emblem. You'll get a special Guardian figure, Blue and Osiris team dossiers, if you're interested, Spartan Locke's classified orders, and a copy of Halo, the Fall of Reach animated series. But most interesting to me was the fact that the Halo 5 Xbox One console, you know, sure, it's going to look pretty and be themed along with the colors and aesthetic, as I said, of Halo 5 Guardians. But the real key point here is that in the details, that it's going to feature metallic blue accents, but it's also going to have Halo-themed sound effects to it.
Yes, so like when you boot up the Xbox, your theme on the Xbox is going to be a Halo theme.
Mm-hmm.
So different than every other regular Xbox in that it's a Halo-themed Xbox.
And I sure hope it also has a special sound effect when you open the CD, or sorry, the disk drive of the system itself. Just, you know, for full authenticity, just go all out. And then when you're going through the menus and everything, so full Halo 5 experience in a physical Xbox form on October 20th.
Indeed.
It's going to run you $500, or if you're in Canada, $550, if not more, considering the loonie continues to decline in value against the American dollar.
Yes, the loonie is now looking to be the peso.
Whew.
Oh, man.
Some brutal dark times.
Indeed.
So $500 if you live in the rich American side of the border, or if you're in the poor Canadian side, more than $500.
Yes.
$550, maybe $600? Hopefully not.
Yeah,
depending on depending on where the currency goes, but you'll have plenty of time to save. October 20th, again, is when it comes out, but if that's just not interesting to you at all and you just want the game, again, October 27th is when you'll be able to get it for realsies this time.
Oh, yeah.
As opposed to just buying the bundle and downloading it, but not being able to play it, which would be like knowing you're getting a specific game at Christmas and then your parents putting it under the tree before Christmas. And you know it's that game?
Yep.
Like, just there's something with the paper where you can kind of see through it.
And you just, you want to play it so bad, but you can't.
Yep.
Because your parents will be mad and disappointed that you couldn't wait.
Oh, they because
will. You showed a demonstrable lack of self-control.
Sure did. They will justifiably ground you.
Yes.
Perhaps even take the game back.
Yep. No Christmas for you, you little shit. I'm extrapolating, of course. I don't know your parents. Your parents might be different. I don't know if my parents would be that harsh, but they would be disappointed if I did something like that. Presuming that I'm still a child and I still would be in that situation, which of course is not the case. However, it's fun to, you know, extrapolate these sorts of ridiculous situations.
It's a thought experiment, if you
yes.
will. And a game that a lot of people, speaking of games that people are waiting for, what many, many people, are waiting for is a game called Mighty No. 9, and they're waiting for it because they helped fund it and bring it, or give it a reason to see the light of day by funding it on Kickstarter.
Yes.
There are tens of thousands of people still waiting to receive their copy of the game since they already paid for it on Kickstarter.
Yep.
And sadly, those people will have to wait longer. I can't say just a bit longer, many months longer.
Yes.
Their patience will be tested.
Yes, unlike the game under the Christmas tree, unlike this game that will exist on your hard drive that will unlock after 7 days that you can't play.
7 days.
brutal. Terrible joke. Just
the ring? No, is it not relevant? Is it too old now for me to make a good ring reference?
Maybe.
Did I lose the crowd? Damn.
But yes, unlike any of those things, this game is not ready yet. This game is not going to be ready for a bit. This game is not going to be released, possibly might not be ready until Q1 of 2016.
This game we're talking about, again, Mighty Number 9. It was originally slated for a mid-September release date, and that has been pushed back by many more months. And you might be wondering, why is it being delayed? Well, the message that was sent to backers and was later posted to by a user onto a NeoGAF forum, where it was then seen by the rest of the world and many other people, was the developer saying that, quote, "We are unable to confirm a final release date at this time. However, we will be aiming for a release in Q1 2016. Once a solid release date is set, we will announce it immediately to our backers and fans." They went on to say that they need the extra time between now and then, whenever the game is released, to fix the bugs that are in the game, saying, quote, "All of the core content for the game is developed and in a complete state. However, there are still bugs and issues pertaining to the online features that are included in the game. These bugs and issues have a direct effect on enjoyment of the game, so a decision was made to work these issues out before release. We appreciate your support and patience regarding the matter and look forward to delivering Mighty No. 9 to our backers and fans in the best state possible." End quote.
So, bad news for people looking forward to Mighty No. 9 next month, because, well, woo, not happening next month, not happening for another probably 6 months.
Yeah, I think.
Which is kind of a crappy bomb to drop on people, but I guess if there's bugs pertaining to the online play that will affect the enjoyment of the game, probably better that they fix them rather than leaving the game in a weird broken state.
That is true.
That will require patching at some point.
Huge patching.
Yeah.
As we looked at the example of the Assassin's Creed game that just came out last year and required so much patching.
Yep.
Like 3 huge patches within the first, what, month? Month and a half?
Yeah, something
like that.
Some short period of time like that.
And I do appreciate the honesty and can respect the honesty on the part of Kaiji Inafune and his Comcept team to state specifically, or not specifically, but more specifically than usual, what the issues are, that there's bugs, again, with the online play that's affecting the overall enjoyment of the game, as opposed to other developers and companies just saying, needs more time for some spit and shine.
Yeah, it's like, oh, we need to put enough polish onto this game to bring you the utmost level of quality that we're blah, blah, blah. Like, great, that's what we expect you to say. That doesn't actually tell us anything. What's the real problem here? It's like, oh, we're having problems with the online part, but, you know, everything is done. We just need some time to fix these bugs. Don't worry. We'll fix the bugs. It's like, okay, good.
Excellent. So Mighty No. 9, whenever it does come out, we'll tell you, of course, about the release date, but it will release for the Xbox 360, Xbox One, PlayStation 3, PlayStation 4, PlayStation Vita, as well as the Wii U, 3DS, and PC platforms, so everything.
Yes, and as we know, Mighty No. 9 is the spiritual successor to Mega Man, Mega Man being, you know, sort of, I mean, Capcom still does stuff here and there with Mega Man, but I want to say it's been a while since there's been like a really good new Mega Man game.
It's kind of like the franchise that Capcom forgot they have.
Or it's like, or they know that they have it, but they're treating it sort of in a nostalgic light. As the next news story that we're talking about here, sort of cements that fact a little bit. I mean, there's a ton of Mega Man games that already exist. Plenty of them. I mean, it's easily enough to make several nostalgia-based collections of.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and that's what they're doing. Another one of.
And we spoke about it a few weeks ago when it was first announced, the Mega Man Legacy Collection, and we maligned it and mocked it back then upon its initial announcement because it's
just a reproduction of a reproduction.
It is collecting the first 6 original Mega Man games from the NES.
Yeah, it's basically a re-release of the Mega Man collection that was on the GameCube, I believe.
And PlayStation 2.
And PlayStation 2.
The Mega Man Anniversary Collection, which had the first 8 Mega Man games.
Yes.
plus some extra arcade games as well.
Yeah. So the one that came out years and years ago for a lesser system had more content than this one.
It sure did. I believe 10 years ago it was, too.
Yes.
Almost though, 10 years ago to the day.
Though granted, that version was terrible. I hated playing that one. They changed the fire and jump buttons around, and you can't do that for those types of games. Like, you can't just change the way your thumb rolls in, like, platformer games. It's not right.
I understand. Once, if you can wrap your brain around it, then you can have an enjoyable experience, but if you can't, and you're just so wired, because that's the natural instinct to have the fire and jump buttons in a certain way.
Just to hold down the fire button all the time, or almost like I did with Mario button, you pretty much have your one portion of the thumb just anchored on the run button, and then you just kind of like jump while keeping your thumb there anchored. That's just like the motion, and it works in Mega Man that way too, because you're charging up your blaster and you just keep it charged as you run through, and then you just release to like fire and you keep charging up and whatever else. I mean, it's super hard to do it the other way. Like, you can't roll your thumb that way. I don't know, I have a hard time picturing it in my mind.
I get it. I totally get where you're coming from. I assume they'll address that issue with this Mega Man Legacy Collection, and we're talking about it because it's the first of four entries in our release date roundup, where there was this week a number of games that were given release dates, so we'll just kind of all give them to you here, this one being the one that is closest to release between now and then. Mega Man Legacy Collection will see a launch on August 25th through the digital channels of the Xbox One, PlayStation 4, and PC. It will also come to the 3DS in a digital form, but that will not be until early 2016. The price for the first six Mega Man NES games is $15.
Yes, but moving from Capcom, who kind of treats Mega Man in a weird nostalgic light, like it's in the past, Nintendo is another company that has a big roster of characters from the past that they keep relevant, or they at least try to keep relevant, even the weirdly strictly nostalgic elements of their characters, like blocky Mario from the first couple of Mario games on the NES, the pixely guys. They still keep relevant. Look at Mario Maker.
That's true.
Things like that. And more recently, or not recently, because Mario Maker is pretty recent as well, but more, you know, abstractly maybe, look at the Amiibos. I mean, they have all sorts of different characters, and it doesn't look like they're going to stop releasing them anytime soon. The Amiibos, they draw from all over the place with their characters, all the way back, you know. In a second, we'll mention how far back they go with one of the new ones that they released, but, you know, they have characters from all over the place that they kind of give a more modern treatment to, and
they do, and as we've said, a lot of the times these figures, they look pretty slick.
Yeah, and like, these are like characters that are in modern games still. Like, even if it was like an old character from 20 years ago, if they release an amiibo for it, it's because there's some modern relevance to it. It's not just like shaded in some weird lens of nostalgia.
And certainly, and for a lot of the characters, they have appearances or make appearances in Super Smash Brothers.
Yes.
And for the first couple of waves, that was the majority of the amiibo lineups were characters in or from Super Smash Brothers, and their amiibo figure would have an effect and impact on the Super Smash Brothers game. But given enough time, you're ultimately going to kind of run out of the Super Smash Brothers rosters, or run out of some of the larger names from that lineup, and you'll maybe be at the lesser popular ones, but still interesting ones all the same, because the latest line of amiibo figures, or latest wave, I should say, of amiibo figures, is going to be coming out on September 11th, same day as Super Mario Maker for the Wii U. Now, the majority of characters in this wave are still from Super Smash Brothers, but they're not the big names.
Yes.
I mean, there's Samus, but it's Zero Suit Samus. There's Ganondorf, but you've already got Link, and you've had Sheik, and I believe Princess Zelda come out as well, so.
Still, having Ganondorf is sort of badass either way.
Certainly, there's Bowser Jr. in the Clown Copter. floaty device thing. And then you'll also have Olimar from the Pikmin series. who also appears, I believe, in Super Smash Brothers. Dr. Mario as well.
Who we talked about at somewhat length last week.
Indeed, which it's kind of weird to see Dr. Mario in a 3D physical form.
Yeah.
I don't know if I can wrap my head around that. Sure, Dr. Mario appears in Smash Brothers, but I don't know. Dr. Mario just was always a 2D thing, and maybe should always be a 2D thing.
Yeah.
Weird to me, but the one that I'm sure a lot of people are going to be looking forward to is the 30th anniversary Mario Amiibo. This one's very unique and stands out from the other Amiibos for two reasons. One, it is not necessarily slick and modern and good-looking, if you wish. It is very blocky.
Yes, it's the pixely Mario from, as I was sort of alluding to earlier, it's the pixely Mario that we knew from the first Super Mario Brothers game on the NES.
Mm-hmm.
Or even the Mario Zookeeper from Donkey Kong, if we want to go back a little bit further.
True, too.
Or just, yeah, so, I mean, it's that Mario, who is, you know, kind of, you know, unmistakably seen through a lens of nostalgia, but knowing Nintendo, they'll actually make it somewhat modernly relevant. They'll bring it. I mean, these Amiibos have to connect to games somehow.
And so this one, the 30th,
has some sort of function in a modern game.
It does. It will connect and have a function with Super Mario Maker, though that connectivity between the two has not been detailed yet. And we should clarify, the 30th anniversary Mario Amiibo that comes out on September 11th is going to be the classic color one.
Yes.
Now you might be wondering, why are we drawing a distinction and specifying classic color? Well, the one that comes out is going to have the red and orangey brown color scheme that Mario from the first NES game did.
Yep.
The modern color one, the one that has the same figure just repainted into his more commonly accepted and present-day colors of red jumpsuit and blue shirt with red hat, that one has a release date of we don't know when, because Nintendo hasn't said yet, but it will come out at a later date. They're separating the two 30th anniversary Mario Amiibos. I assume the modern one will come out closer to towards Christmas. Perhaps indeed. There's another wave of them.
But the other wave, which will happen later in September, is the Retro 3-Pack, which will release on September 25th, which is a bundle that consists of Duck Hunt, you know, the dog and the duck.
Yes.
Rob the robot,
mm-hmm.
From Gyromite, Mr. Game & Watch.
And Mr. Game & Watch.
Yes, and Mr. Game & Watch.
It's a 3-Pack.
It's a 3-Pack. Yes. Apologies for the errant lack of the word "and" there to denote the end of the list.
It's okay. It's accepted.
Yes, we could just call that an audio Oxford comma, perhaps. Yeah, Mr. Game & Watch, the third one.
Indeed, and these, of course, all coming out because they all tie into Super Smash Brothers.
Yes.
Duck Hunt dog in there with the duck on his back.
Yep.
One of the weirder characters to ever make it into a Smash Brothers game.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, right up there with the Wii Fit trainer.
Yes, certainly. Mr. Game & Watch, of course. Mr. Game & Watch, very thin, very true to his appearance.
Very two-dimensional.
Very much so. There was also supposed to be another 3-pack of Amiibo figures of Mii Fighters, the three different classes that your Mii can fight as in Smash Brothers, that was slated for launch in September, but it has been pushed back until November. So that is unfortunate, but I suppose in November we'll see the launch of other Amiibo figures that have yet to be announced because, well, November is prime Christmas shopping season, and Nintendo would be remiss to let that opportunity go.
Yes, maybe they'll release one that relates to this other game that's getting released, related to this other game that's going to be released that we'll mention right now.
Indeed.
Of course, being The Legend of Zelda Triforce Heroes.
Naturally, the big Legend of Zelda 3DS entry this year, the one that is very much a spiritual successor to Four Swords Adventures from the GameCube Game Boy Advance days.
Although, which was the spiritual successor to Link to the Past, of course.
It was. So it all comes together.
Indeed.
This one, however, lacking any connectivity to the main TV console, unlike Four Swords Adventures, but still a multiplayer adventure all the same, and this one will feature three different Links, the red, the green, and the blue Link, in which players will be able to team up and join together to solve different puzzles and get through different dungeons as the multiple Links. You can also form a totem pole of Link. So perhaps that's an amiibo, the totem pole Link? Or it's sold as a three-pack and you can connect them and then stack them and form the totem pole.
That could very well be.
Seeing it. Marketing opportunity. There you go, Nintendo. Another good idea for free. but it's coming out on October 23rd. So mark your calendars. So it's, you know, Nintendo kind of pacing themselves out. They've got some big releases in September. This is a big one for October. Of course, they'll have a few more in November as well. So it's all right. Nintendo's fall is shaping up. That's looking very nice. But one last item to get to in our release date roundup. It is something that you won't really have to worry about for the Christmas shopping season, but maybe it's something that you'll use some of your Christmas money towards, or your gift card for whatever store, or
your paycheck or your bank account that is recovering after the devastation laid to it after the Christmas season. You just want a little bit of me time in front of a video game console, and you want something to just turn your brain off, and it'll be a little bit fun, it'll be a little bit silly. This game probably would fit that bill.
I can certainly think it would. It is another entry in the LEGO series of games, in which it is a LEGO-fied version of another entertainment property. This time, it is LEGO Marvel's Avengers. Now, it is slated for a release on January 26th of 2016, so an exact month after Christmas, so you'll have plenty of time to go back to work, perhaps pick up overtime, perhaps a second job to help refill your bank account, and then afford this game.
Yes.
What second job
specifically for this game?
A second job with overtime, after you worked overtime at your first job. So yes. You can be rolling in the overtime. And thus you will have really earned the ability to sit down and relax and enjoy yourself. What this is, what LEGO Marvel's Avengers is, the game, it is interpreting the first two of Marvel's Avengers movies through LEGO into the video game form. So you're going to see Thor, Iron Man, Hulk, Hawkeye, Black Widow, Captain America, Loki, Ultron, everyone you'd expect to see from the Marvels or Marvel Avengers movies, but Legoized and in a video game, which will also include other characters that weren't in the Marvel movies. I believe just announced this week was the news that the very popular and current Ms. Marvel, Kamala Khan from the comics, will make her video game debut in Lego Marvel's Avengers.
Indeed.
And also Jane Foster from the Thor universe will be in the game as well.
Maybe some other Avengers that probably can't be in movies.
Quite possibly.
Maybe LEGO will finagle the licensing properly.
Oh, fingers crossed. And also going to be in the game is Squirrel Girl, one of the more obscure Avengers characters there has ever been, but apparently she is going to make it in the game as well.
Which is a good sign.
Certainly. And also, this game, because it's Marvel and LEGO, has a sense of humor. Stan Lee's in the game.
Of course.
He was in the previous LEGO Marvel game, LEGO Marvel Super Heroes. This time he's in there with the Stan Buster. Might be wondering what that is. Well, did you see Avengers 2? You know the scene where Iron Man and Hulk fight? Iron Man's in the Hulk Buster suit. He doesn't say it specifically, but that's just what it's commonly known
as. It's the Hulk Buster, yeah.
It's the Hulk Buster suit. So imagine that, the Hulkbuster suit, but Stan Lee. There you go.
Just silly.
So the game, again, coming out January 26th of 2016. It, similar to Mighty No. 9, coming out for literally everything. Xbox One, Xbox 360, PlayStation 4, PlayStation 3, the Vita, 3DS, Wii U, and PC. Because Traveler's Tales, they do a good job, as does Warner Brothers, of trying to reach as many people as possible and recoup their investment.
Indeed.
Because they're business people and they understand the value of a dollar.
Yep.
And they want all the dollars, because they value all the dollars.
Yes, valuing all the dollars is a thing that business people do. Something we do as well. We're not necessarily business people, but we are people. I think most people can appreciate a good dollar.
Certainly, and we appreciate dollars as well, so if anyone wants to, you know, give us a dollar, we'll certainly take it. And we'll value it.
I don't know if that's necessarily where I was going with that. Nope. I don't know where I was going with that. I was trying to awkwardly transition into the fact that we are starting to run out of time on this program, and maybe time is money? Maybe that's what my brain was jumping at? I don't know. I don't want to say that I want to stop talking because my time is worth too much.
You're on vacation.
But I'm on vacation, exactly.
But maybe you'd like to get back to your vacation and enjoying it, and so for that reason we will get to our last part of the program, which is always the last part of every program. It is the Blast from the Past, which this week we have two items to get to. We have a movie and an album. The movie is 30 years old. The album is 45 years old. Two large milestone anniversaries. One, the movie, very much an item from the 80s.
Yes.
Very 80s, and I think we should start there for the 80s nostalgia. A lot of people, if you're of a certain generation, you remember waking up on Saturday mornings, going downstairs, or going into the living room, turning on the TV. You probably even had to actually physically interact with the television.
You may have even had to click a dial around.
Yes.
Like, you had to, like, move a dial that, like, awkwardly made some loud clicking sounds off the TV. I had to do that anyway.
Well, I remember doing that as well. And flipping through the channels because you wanted to watch Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Yes, the strange children's show starring Paul Rubens as the iconic Pee-wee Herman.
Mm-hmm. The man-child.
Yes.
So in his wild, zany adventures in his house with that was basically looked like a giant acid trip.
Yes, the whole house was basically alive. We're not necessarily talking about this show, but that was what most of us, that's where most of us knew Pee-wee Herman from.
Mm-hmm.
But Pee-wee Herman had a little bit of a lineage before that, as like a character that Paul Rubens used to do stand-up as, and also was in a couple of movies. So yeah, interestingly enough, most people will think this is crazy, but check the Wikipedia page. I'm not lying about this. The first movie Paul Rubens was in as Pee-wee Herman was Cheech and Chong's next movie.
Figure that one out.
Yeah, figure that one out. So Cheech and Chong's next movie, it was sort of like he brought his character Pee-wee Herman to life in this movie, who he was sort of performing around in clubs because he sort of got rejected from SNL.
Mm-hmm.
because he applied to be on the 1980-81 season, which I think had like some other huge names like Eddie Murphy and stuff on it, which would have been crazy, but either way, he got rejected from it, understandably. So in getting rejected, he made his own thing. So he made a play or a stage show surrounding his character, which was a little bit more adult back then.
It certainly was.
And then he parlayed that into an HBO series, which again was more adult because it was HBO. And then the couple of movies happened, or the first movie happened, I should say. This being the first movie, being Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which was from 1985.
August 9th of 1985.
Yes, which was really like the first big explosion of Pee-wee Herman into pop culture consciousness, not counting his HBO show, which maybe not everyone saw.
Certainly not. A select audience would have had HBO, and only a select audience would have seen Cheech and Chong's next movie, but this one really brought him to a far more accessible mainstream audience with, I guess, toning down the character a bit from where he would have been in the HBO series. And this one is, Pee-wee's Big Adventure has kind of a weird story behind it. It's very much 80s, but it's Paul Rubens doing a story about, well, his bicycle being, or as Pee-wee Herman doing a story about his bicycle being stolen and going on an adventure across America to find his bicycle again.
Yes, and in case, like, you're just thinking of Pee-wee Herman and blah, 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 whatever kids show, think about this for a second. This was a movie directed by Tim Burton in 1985, written by Paul Rubens, along with Michael Varhall and Phil Hartman. Phil Hartman was one of the three primary writers of this movie. So, I don't know if you have any sort of like sense of what that means, but Phil Hartman, in my mind, is one of like, you know, a comedy legend, really.
One of the greatest performers ever on Saturday Night Live.
Yes, as well as other programs as well. I mean, his performances in The Simpsons were super memorable. I also just loved his sense of like, his sense of writing and everything. Like, he had some pretty ludicrous ideas. I will forever go back to his virtual books commercial, virtual reality books commercial. It'll always come back to that because that's such a great commercial on Saturday Night Live. Just to kind of like peer into the, like, the ludicrous mind of Phil Hartman.
Touche. And I do want to point out, you mentioned this was directed by Tim Burton.
And music by Danny Elfman. The dream team, really.
Certainly. And this was the start of the partnership between Danny Elfman and Tim Burton, because this was apparently Tim Burton's first time directing a feature-length movie. Now, we think of Tim Burton as being, well, he did Batman, he's done Beetlejuice, he did
Nightmare Before Christmas.
He's done so many things.
Yeah.
Corpse Bride, just to name a few. Alice in Wonderland, most recently for Disney. He's just done so many things. This prolific actor, director.
He puts his very specific stamp on things. You can tell when something is a Tim Burton movie. Mm-hmm. When you just look at it, really.
There's a certain, you know, sometimes creepy aesthetic or gothic sensibility to it, but he directed the Pee-wee Herman movie, Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Now, most of us think of Pee-wee Herman as the kid show. So you have the guy who's, you know, known for his kind of creepiness, gothic sensibilities, doing the movie of a character we most often think as a kid's character, or a kid show character.
Yeah.
In his feature-length debut. With Danny Elfman, who used to be the lead singer of Oingo Boingo.
Yep.
But left because of this and the work and just the time, the demands on his time for scoring the movie and whatnot. Oh, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure, as I said, based around finding his bicycle, and he goes across America to find it, meets all sorts of characters, is kind of based on a 1940s or 1950s French movie. In which the idea of it is that, well, it's about someone looking for their stolen bicycle, or their lost bicycle.
Yeah, so I mean, when you think about it in that term, it's just like this weird avant-garde movie done by a virtually unknown director, starring this super weird character that
was niche and cult.
Niche and cult, co-written by Phil Hartman, who at that time would have been sort of like, I guess near the end of his SNL run.
Phil Hartman?
Yeah, or I guess in the middle of his SNL run, really.
Or probably just at the beginning, I'd say.
I guess that's true. I mean,
I think he was a late 80s edition.
Right, okay. So then Phil Hartman, who is still hasn't really established himself comedically yet.
No.
Based on this weird French movie from the 40s, it had all the makings of failure, yet somehow it didn't.
It was a success.
It was a box office smash. I mean, it made $40 million. It had a $6 million budget. Yep, that's a success.
And because of the family-friendly nature of the film, it was a year later that Pee-wee's Playhouse actually hit the airwaves.
Yes.
As a Saturday morning kid show.
Yeah, where it stayed on the air for 5 years, I believe.
That's right.
And also in the midst of that, another movie came out as well, Big Top Pee-wee, but still, Pee-wee Herman is one of those distinctly 80s entities that you can only really like describe as like, well, it was the 80s, and it's super hard to explain like this character because it's like one character, yet somehow it's so malleable that can fit into any weird situation.
But it's connected to so many other talented people. It's not just one character that we think of being associated with an ad campaign or anything of that nature, or just a one-hit wonder off a TV show. It's a character that existed in a couple different forms at a couple different times. Again, as an HBO series, then a family-friendly movie, then
a kids' TV show.
A kids' TV show. And then it's slated to come back with a movie for Netflix or Amazon.
Which I think will probably be more adult-oriented again.
Very likely. With involvement from Judd Apatow.
I could see that as well. I mean,
figure that one out.
The character has always kind of lent itself to talented people. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, Cyndi Lauper did the theme for the TV show, the kids' TV show, unless I'm totally remembering this wrong.
You're on an island for that one. I do not recall the theme of the Saturday morning TV show at all. Ultimately, when I was watching it, I was just trying to either get through the show until Ninja Turtles came on, because I was that kid.
Yeah, so was I, truthfully. Though, looking back at the show, it is a very interesting... Well, everything involving Pee Wee Herman was very interesting, and it's worth looking back at again.
It definitely is very unique, very odd, very artistic, if you will.
Yeah, interestingly enough, just a little bit of a thing here, right from the Wikipedia page, because why not read from Wikipedia when you have it in front of you?
I tend to trust it for most things pop culture.
Yeah, apparently Variety at the time, when they were doing their review of the movie, they were comparing Paul Reubens to Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton. So
really?
So super high praise there. If you have any sort of sense, you know, of, you know, film history or whatnot, you know that that's pretty high praise.
They are the two staples of silent movies.
Well, they were comedy legends, really. They sort of shaped the face of film comedy. I mean, silent movies to start with, and Charlie Chaplin later went on to do talkies as well, mm-hmm. still to success. And, yeah, it's just, that's a pretty huge comparison.
Wow!
So, really, that should speak volumes to this, if you've never seen Pee-wee's Big Adventure, or you just haven't seen in a long time, like myself. I'm probably going to go back and watch this sometime very shortly.
And certainly, just to see some of the, you know, various cameos that appear, obviously Phil Hartman makes an appearance
yep.
in the film, but as I was reading around, also Cassandra Peterson is in the movie, a.k.a. Elvira, Mistress of the Dark.
Oh, yes. Another distinctly 80s character.
Certainly. she has a cameo appearance in it amongst many other individuals as well, so Pee-wee's Big Adventure. Definitely go worth checking out because Pee Wee Herman, not really a name that you hear too often these days. Sadly, a name that you also don't hear too often these days is that of Frank Zappa.
Indeed, we've talked about him quite a bit on this program. We're fans of his here, for his fusion of musical virtuosity and, you know, bringing an air of silliness to it and making it sort of accessible with silly lyrics or whatnot mm-hmm. on occasion.
However, we find ourselves this week talking about an album that is more for the diehard, musically artistic individuals who want a good challenge.
Yes, those who prefer more avant-garde music.
Certainly. If you, over the years in our talking of Frank Zappa, have explored Frank Zappa, his music, have started at the more accessible albums and worked your way up, this is a good intermediate challenge for you. Intermediate to high challenge for you. We are speaking of the album that came out on August 10th of 1970 from Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. This is Weasels Ripped My Flesh.
Yes. Definitely not an album I have listened to as much as others of his, but has like one of like the staple Frank Zappa tracks on it, oddly enough, despite being sort of like a bit of a challenging listen at times. It has like the classic, My Guitar Wants to Kill Your Mama.
Indeed.
Which is a classic Frank Zappa track. It's been redone several times by various iterations of his band, when he was still alive, that is.
Certainly. And this was a late era Mothers album, if I recall correctly, too.
Yeah, there was only a few, like, this was, you know, under the banner of the Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention. There was a few more albums by the Mothers of Invention after that, but not too many. And now that might sound like it's like, oh, a few more albums, that can't be late era. But no, remember, Frank Zappa was a very, very, very prolific person. So in the grand scheme of Frank Zappa, who had like something like 80 albums or 90 albums or something ludicrous like that, you know, when there was only like what, 8 or 9 Mothers albums, when you're on like the 6th or 7th album of the Mothers, yeah, it's sort of like, you can say, yeah, not really that, like late era, really. Mm-hmm.
Certainly. And we say it's a challenging listen because, well, a lot of the songs on the album, outside of My Guitar Wants to Kill Your Mama, don't really follow standard pop or rock song signatures or hallmarks.
They borrow way more from the jazz movement.
Very much so. There's even one song on the album that openly has Frank Zappa talking over the instrumentation, pointing out the time signatures of the different instruments. And I think the 4 or 5 that he goes through that I recall hearing, they're all in different time signatures as they're being played. Which, it's weird, and you wouldn't think works, and it kind of doesn't, because we're so used to hearing things in, you know, very standard time signatures, everything being in perfectly synchronized now, but...
You know, 4-4, common time.
Certainly. But when you hear, like, the tambourine being in, like, you know, was it 7-4 time or something like that, it's kind of weird. It's neat, it's different.
Yep.
But it's not like cruising music, not like I'm cruising around town or I have company over, so I'll put this on as gentle background music for the dinner party.
It's a bit jarring, and it's borrowing a lot from the avant-garde and free jazz movements, which aren't the easiest of the jazz movements to listen to.
Certainly not. A lot of it sounds like, you know, perhaps free jamming that was then coalesced into this form, but if you are wanting something to listen to from the Frank Zappa collection as you just sit there in your chair and say a lazy Sunday afternoon with just your headphones on and just want to really explore some of his deeper works, if you will, some of his less well-known bodies of work, then this is perhaps something for you. So then you can really just be primetime music snob and just lord this over people's head and say, you know, you haven't really heard Frank Zappa till you've heard Weasels Rip My Flesh, and the movement on this one song is, if that's your thing, cool, or you just want to see how far you can delve into Frank Zappa, then this is also up your alley. Again, Weasels Ripped My Flesh by Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, celebrating its 45th anniversary on August 10th. Or if you just want to kick back and relax with a very 80s movie and just try to understand Pee-wee Herman, the popularity of the character and who it was and how it all kind of existed in the 80s, but looking back on it through the lens of 30 years on, then sit down and watch Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which celebrates its 30th anniversary on August 9th.
Indeed.
So those are your blasts from the past for this week. We encourage you to check out and try them in whatever forms and ways or means you go about doing it. Or if you have other suggestions or wish to, maybe write us and say that Weasels Rip My Flesh is not as challenging a Frank Zappa album to listen to as we are making it out to be and want to tell us we're wrong, then feel free to write us and tell us how wrong we are. You can do that by emailing us info@thearcadeshow.com or simply using the contact us form on our website, thearcadeshow.com. Or you can also reach out to us on Twitter. You can follow us and send us a direct message. We are at The Arcade Show, and on Facebook, facebook.com/TheArcadeShow. Check us out and like us on Facebook to get the full arcade experience. Well, that about wraps us up for this week's edition, so we shall take our leave and simply say until next week, everybody, good night.
Good night.